So my main goal today is to try to persuade you that philosophy's past offers a means to empower its present. I have my work cut out for me, so let's get to it. The philosophical past that can empower the present is not the one you've been taught. The history of philosophy we've learned needs revision. The philosophical past that can empower the present is not the one that generally we study in our classes. So the first question for me to address is, well, exactly what is the history of philosophy that needs to be revised? Way back in 1981, David Fate Norton offered this brilliant parody. I wish I had a kind of Judy Dench voice, but I'll do my best. It came to pass that darkness covered the face of the earth, and the Creator saw that the darkness is evil. And he spoke out, saying, "Let there be light." And there was light, and he called the light Renaissance. And thus it was that Descartes begat Spinoza, and Spinoza begat Leibniz, and Locke begat Berkeley, and Berkeley begat Hume. And then it was that there arose the great sage of Königsberg, the great Immanuel Kant, who, though neither empiricist nor rationalist, was likened to both. He it is who would combine the eye of the scientist with the mind of the mathematician. And this too the Creator saw, and he saw that it was good. And he sent godly men and scholars true to tell the story wherever men should henceforth gather to speak of sages past. So the history of philosophy that we've been taught is like a series of beads on a string from one great man to one great man. As we'll see, the myth is just that, a great, big, made-up story. We can pretty quickly dispense with the claim about Descartes breaking radically with the past to start something brand new. It will take more time to convince you that the beads on the string approach to the history of philosophy is misguided. Neither Descartes' contemporaries nor his immediate successors took his metaphysics to be all that new and exciting. Philosophers like Leibniz, for example, and many others, regularly note the debt Descartes owes to past philosophers, especially to Augustine. A prominent 17th century philosopher, Pierre Bell, for example, maligns Descartes for pirating ideas from earlier sources without acknowledging. While it's true that Descartes' natural philosophy was important and original, many of his contemporaries found his metaphysical proposals second rate. For example, Henry Moore, the famous Cambridge philosopher, who was likely the first proponent of Cartesianism in England, writes, and I quote, "While I can never highly enough admire Descartes as a mechanical wit, he is no master of metaphysics." Finally, on to the point of Descartes' originality. In a couple of papers of mine, I exposed Descartes' debt to the late medieval meditative genre. Now, here's a little cheat sheet if you'd like it. I did an article for the New York Times. I'll say more about the meditative tradition later, but the point now is that there was a long-standing and rich medieval tradition which Descartes and his contemporaries knew very well, in which Descartes both uses and diverges from in his own work. Like Descartes, 16th century meditators sought self-understanding and knowledge of metaphysical truths, and notice this, many often faced deceitful demons along the way. That is, the danger posed by deceiving demons to a truth-seeking meditator was a well-used trope. But it was the 16th century Spanish nun who became canonized, Teresa of Avila, who was almost certainly the first philosopher to assign deceiving demons the power to force the meditator to withdraw assent from all of her former beliefs. And like Descartes, Teresa rids herself of doubt through a careful examination of her mind and its capacities. This, by the way, are these are illustrations I'll show you too that were done in a sort of summary of her work in the mid-17th century. In the first, she's contemplating on herself and attempting to find God, and notice an evil deceiver enters the room and tries to take her off course. She then realigns her thinking, focusing a little bit more on herself and trying to understand her her ideas a bit better, and in the end manages to find certainty. And notice this, she then casts the demons away. I kind of love this demon. He kind of almost feels sorry for this demon here. Now, Descartes would have learned all about Teresa as a boy in his Jesuit school. And if that's not enough, while Descartes was writing his own meditations, Teresa was all the rage among French intellectuals. That's right. This orgasmic Spanish saint wrote a spiritual meditation with astonishing philosophical flourishes. Why have philosophers entirely ignored Teresa of Avila? Probably, partly because she was categorized as a mystic, and a female one at that, but also because, as a clever woman, she had to present her philosophical ideas as part of a spiritual exploration. Teresa didn't write philosophy in any of the standard genres. Historians of philosophy did not recognize her philosophical authority, and so they ignored her. And yet, her philosophical and religious ideas were hotly debated in the period. As Jesuit missionaries began to colonize the world in the late 16th century, they took Teresa's books with them. In the 17th century, she became a global phenomenon. Teresa was a global star with a long line of great and promising followers. I think of her as a 17th century version of Beyoncé. Beyoncé is here in full maternal regalia, looking a little bit like the Madonna. Now, what Beyoncé was or is now into the 21st century, Teresa was to 17th century philosophy and theology. Her ideas and creative power could not be ignored. Okay, now fast forward to Kant. And by the way, I'm really very, very proud of the fact that I managed to justify talking about Teresa of Avila, Beyoncé, and Kant all in the same paragraph. I dare, Tommy, you to do that next year. So anyway, fast forward to Kant, who does not include Descartes in his list of prominent figures in the history of philosophy. To be sure, Kant was interested in Descartes' philosophy, along with the philosophy of other 17th century thinkers, but the figures he considers most important in the lead up to his philosophy are Leibniz, Locke, and of course his dogmatic alarm clock, David Hume. But now we face another question, perhaps more distressing than the first. If significant bits of our beloved story about the development of modern philosophy are inaccurate, why have we believed them for so long? In short, what the heck? It was in France in the 18th century when philosophers began to describe Descartes as a person who created a brand new philosophy by means of his cogito and its subjective turn. But it was German post-Kantian philosophers who created the first full-throated myth, according to which Descartes created new ways of thinking. And that new mode of philosophizing conveniently led to themselves as its hero. In his 1820 lectures on the history of philosophy, Hegel credits Descartes with breaking wholly with the past and setting the stage for the greatness of his own philosophy, dramatically claiming, I really think this is pretty amazing, Germanic, i.e. modern philosophy, begins with Descartes. 25 years later, in 1847, Schopenhauer insists, I quote, "Our excellent Descartes is the instigator of subjective investigation and in this, the father of modern philosophy." That is, prominent 19th century German thinkers increasingly saw Descartes as the originator of a set of philosophical concerns of their liking. But it was probably someone you've never heard of, Kuno Fischer, a brilliant lecturer and prominent professor in Heidelberg, who codified the first full-blown story of Descartes as our father in his multi-volume History of Philosophy, which went through numerous editions and was translated, for example, into English. Fisher turns Descartes into a romantic hero who courageously yearned for, and I quote, complete mental renovation, and whose Meditations is the most animated and captivating work in the entire history of philosophy. As far as I can tell, Fisher seems to be the first person to suggest that Descartes began a school, which he dubs rationalism, which itself then provoked a different approach to philosophy, which he dubbed empiricism. In the early decades of the 20th century, prominent philosophers like Ernst Cassirer and Etienne Gilson confirmed Descartes' philosophical heroism. In Cassirer's dramatic telling, Descartes single-handedly created, and I quote, the spiritual essence of a new epoch which would permeate all fields of knowledge, to which 18th century philosophers would respond, and out of which Kant and other German thinkers would arise. He explains that historians can understand, and again I quote, the sum total of the philosophies of the period's philosophical content by following step by step the triumphal march, these are his words, of the modern analytic spirit. And so we did. But now another question arises. A lot of you might say, well, okay, so Descartes was not as prominent as Fisher and Cassirer would have us believe, and the myth is in some sense an invented story. But you know, those systems are philosophically extremely rich and engaging. And so they are. Those of us who engage in what we call the New Narratives Project agree that our canonical figures are philosophically rich and very much worth studying. We do not, I repeat, we do not want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. But we do think that in treating the history of philosophy as a triumphal march from great man and great system to great man and great system, we lose a very great deal. Before I turn to examples of what we lose, let's consider a standard way of teaching early modern philosophy, which will highlight the need for a somewhat radical rethinking. Consider a popular anthology by Roger Ariev and Eric Watkins, who are both excellent historians of philosophy, by the way. In the first edition of their anthology in 1998, they included excerpts from the list of authors, exactly the authors in our myth. Then, in response to a broadening of philosophical context, they included in their 2009 edition a few pages from Montaigne, Isaac Newton, and Thomas Reed, excerpts deemed relevant to the central problems raised by canonical figures. In 2015, Andrew Janiak and I published an op-ed in the Washington Post in which, among other things, we called out this edition for not including any women, any of the well-recognized women authors of the period. So, in their brand new third edition, they include, and I write, as they say this in their introduction, they write, selections from the corpus of traditionally underrepresented philosophers, which is, of course, long overdue. So the good news is that they include excerpts from three brilliant, wonderful, interesting 17th century women philosophers, Elizabeth of Bohemia, Anne Conway, and Margaret Cavendish. But the disappointing news is that the myth still prevails. The added excerpts are ones in which women directly criticize the canonical figure so that it's impossible to surmise their own philosophical systems in positive proposals. As usual, the women are mere accessories to the men. But equally troubling is the fact that the anthology excludes any recognition of the non-standard problems that were of great concern to these women. Problems concerning war, suffering, inequality, and what we now call epistemic injustice. That is, the anthology continues to focus on exactly the same topics selected by our 19th century mythmakers. I would have us empower philosophy by widening the scope of the topics we study and the problems we pose, and by taking seriously the kinds of texts that were written by brilliant, though marginalized, philosophers. Given our 20th century concerns with education, justice, inequality, social hierarchy, sex, gender, dignity, health, epistemic injustice, war, peace, and discrimination, I could go on. And given that the history of philosophy treats all of these topics, the time seems right to uncork the power of philosophy's past. Okay, what I've done so far is to give a genealogy of the story we tell ourselves about the history of philosophy as a triumphal march from great man to great man. Now that we understand the story's historical contingency, I hope that you might be somewhat curious about what we've been missing. What other sorts of ideas and arguments are there? But before I turn to a couple of examples, let me address a perfectly reasonable question that non-historians in the audience might be asking. Namely, how does this project of producing new narratives have anything to do with you? You might reasonably note that your work has nothing to do with philosophy's past in any way. The topics we inherited from these German dudes about, for example, subjectivity, causation, and so on, are richly philosophical. In brief, you might insist that the status quo is working just fine. My response is that it's pretty clearly not working. Harsh fact one, the humanities in general and philosophy departments in particular are under threat. Our enrollments are decreasing. There's a non-trivial number of universities and colleges looking to eliminate or defund philosophy programs. Harsh fact two, philosophy as a discipline continues to have a lower percentage of women and people of color than any other discipline in the humanities or social sciences. Many of us who have taken up the task of reconsidering philosophy's past were ourselves very well off given the status quo. I worked on Leibniz for 15 years and still find his philosophy exhilarating. But like so many of us who have joined, the New Narratives Project, I was motivated by the great Eileen O'Neill to apply my efforts to making philosophy better. Here's how. Empowering philosophy, so the second part of my presentation. There are two straightforward means to use philosophy's past to empower our discipline. The first is to ask new questions of our canonical figures and that have contemporary relevance. The second is to include philosophically rich texts by women, people of color, Islamicut and Jewish thinkers who were left out of philosophy's past, but whose work have contemporary relevance. Both of these strategies for using philosophy's past to empower our discipline are fundamentally projects of retrieval. The process of retrieval is straightforward enough. Historians of philosophy broaden the scope of their research with an eye to excavating and explicating historical text and topics that provoke the kinds of conversations we need to be having. Whether or not you teach courses that normally include historical materials, there are ways of doing so that will provoke important conversations. To be clear, the myth of modern philosophy was built around a few philosophical problems. The myth then sustained interest in those problems. When we use philosophy's past to empower the discipline, we don't just study history willy-nilly. We rummage around for topics and texts that raise new problems, problems that speak to us now. Again, to be clear, those of us who promote new narratives don't intend to reject the topics at the core of the myth. Rather, we want to find new topics to place next to the old ones. As a historian of philosophy, I've become interested in what I call conceptual genealogies, especially ones involving social hierarchies. Thanks to the important new work, or recent work, of critical race theorists, feminist philosophers, and so on, we understand a lot about how racism and sexism work, about forms of epistemic injustices, about the struggles of marginalized people. The topics that I've selected and will tell you about briefly as a means to do this genealogical project, are ones that cluster around social hierarchies. They're topics of central interest to our current students and to our world. But the standard history of philosophy has entirely ignored those topics. One could argue that the standard approach to philosophy's past has allowed us to practice what social epistemologists call epistemic ignorance. Epistemologists like Nancy Twana and standpoint theorists like Sandra Harding have noted that the production of ignorance needs to be understood as a substantive practice itself. I want to suggest that our ignorance of parts of canonical systems exemplifies what has been called invested ignorance, namely an ignorance, in the words of Cynthia Townley, sustained to misrepresent reality in ways that are not coincidentally, sustain patterns of privilege. Our tenacious commitment to a few great men marching in triumph to us has kept us ignorant, not just of non-canonical systems in philosophy's past, but even to major parts of canonical ones. An important example of such tenacious ignorance is the study of Kant. Charles Mills's retrieval of Kant's three articles on race has generated, and rightly so, important discussions by Thomas McCarthy, Robert Bernasconi, and others about the inner workings of Kant's system. As these scholars show, Kant's arguments for the inferiority of Africans compared to Europeans are not independent of his system. Rather, those arguments rely on assumptions that are integral to his system. The retrieval of Kant's views about racial hierarchies, which are obviously relevant to topics relevant to us today, have provoked historians to raise interesting questions about Kant's anthropology and teleology. In Resisting Reality, Sally Haslinger makes much of the social production of dominant and subordinate groups, of social hierarchies, which she argues are crucial to understanding kinds of agency. In Kate Mann's recent prize-winning book, Down Girl, The Logic of Misogyny, Mann interrogates the complicated ways that misogyny works to sustain patriarchy. She defines patriarchy as a system by means of which men control women, sexism as the branch of patriarchal ideology that justifies and rationalizes a patriarchal social order, and misogyny as a system that polices and enforces patriarchy's governing norms and expectations. I've recently tried to contribute to this discussion of the production of social hierarchies, though granted in a somewhat nerdy fashion, by offering a genealogy of sexism and misogyny in historical text. In a paper I wrote for an issue of Philtopics, edited by Kate Mann and Bianca Takauka, I recreate the ancient arguments that were used to motivate what I call hierarchical difference. Hierarchical difference is the view, we're going to talk about this, is the view that female bodies are inferior to male bodies, from which it is supposed to follow that women are morally inferior to men and should be treated and especially educated differently. Aristotle famously begins his metaphysics with the pronouncement that people by nature desire to know, but strangely, philosophers have not been concerned to know about, to learn about, Aristotle's biological writings as they relate to his philosophical system. I'll now show that when we place Aristotle's biological writings within the context of his philosophy, we can discern the powerful argument he gives for hierarchical difference, an argument that is perfectly consistent with his metaphysical, physical, and ethical views. Because of the rigor and thoughtfulness of Aristotle's system and its wide-ranging influence, his argument for hierarchical difference laid the foundations for millennia of Western sexism and misogyny. Aristotle's arguments for hierarchical difference are best understood within the context of the following set of assumptions, which I dub the metaphysics of right agency. Assumption one, human beings are truth-seeking agents with innate capacities to attain ultimate knowledge. That is knowledge that will allow the agent to get life right. There are ultimate truths, knowledge of which are necessary and for some thinkers sufficient to get life right. A proper education or a correct methodology promotes the development of agents' capacities so they will acquire the ultimate truths and get life right. Now, getting life right in the history of philosophy, of course, is described in many different ways. The most common is to have wisdom, acquire wisdom, or virtue, or have a life worth living. For some people, it's to acquire a relationship with the divinity. For some people, let's say like Leibniz and Descartes, it's to understand the most profound metaphysical truths and what they entail. In the history of philosophy, it turns out that the most influential arguments for hierarchical difference make significant uses of the notions of teleology and health. In his Oxford Philosophical Concepts book, it's a series I oversee with that Tommy mentioned, in the book on health, Peter Adamson notes that the concept of health is unusual in seeming to straddle the divide between descriptive, empirical concepts and normative ones, value-laden ones. The simplest version of teleology is something like this, that something happens or exists for the sake of other things. So some people go to the APA for the sake of seeing friends and hanging out. Oh, whoops. What I should say is that people go to the APA for the sake of philosophical enlightenment. Sorry about that. As we will see, robust teleology and related notions of health help justify and explain the inferiority of women. Although I once set my sights on Aristotle, first a bit of Plato as background. In his dialogue, The Phaedo, Plato is clear that, we philosophers have set our sights on wisdom, that the truth-seeking agent is a soul, and that the means to get things right requires that the soul separate itself as much as possible from the body, so that, and I quote, it can abide in reason and dwell alone by itself. If the soul does not purge itself of bodily matters, then it will never attain the moral ideal. So the Phaedo suggests that getting things right requires that the soul purges itself of the body, where it then abides in reason. The Phaedo's account of the soul appears to render it genderless, from which it would seem to follow that the souls in female bodies are identical in power and capacities to those in male bodies. And if the souls of men and women are equally capable of attaining wisdom, then it would seem to follow that all agents are equal in their capacities to get life right. But here's the rub. Except for the priestess Diotima, who in Plato's Symposium is described, and I quote, as a woman wise about many things, and we don't know, by the way, if Diotima is a fictional or real person. But except for her, women do not appear as interlocutors anywhere in Plato's dialogues, even as the sacrificial victims of the Socratic method. Now, how might someone who endorses Plato's apparent views about a genderless soul account for the fact that so few women in the dialogues engage in philosophical discussions, much less become philosophers? Might there be something about the female body that makes it harder for its soul to purge itself of bodily associations and abide in reason? A Platonist could consistently believe that all souls are equal in capacities, but that female bodies are harder for the genderless soul to escape. Plato suggests something like this in the Timaeus his mythic account of how the world might have been created. By the way, it's important that the Timaeus is one of the two Platonic dialogues available during medieval Europe. In that dialogue, the narrator spins a tale according to which gods first created men and then punished those, I quote, who lived lives of cowardice or injustice by turning them into women in their next lives. That is, the Timaeus suggests that women are a degraded state of humanity, a kind of punishment that results from improper behavior. Now, what about women's bodies might make them so degraded? Enter Aristotle, who argues for a robust form of hierarchical difference. For him, women are inferior to men in their bodies and souls. Teleology is the framing notion of Aristotle's philosophy. All living things are active and in their agency seek the good. In his Nicomachean Ethics, as probably everybody in this room knows, human good is defined as rational activity in accordance with virtue. So Aristotle's version of our metaphysics of right agency seems straightforward enough. Human beings have an innate capacity to seek good. Aristotle's ethics shows them how to get that. It would appear then, on the basis of the ethical works, that Aristotle might be willing to think of women as capable of acquiring virtue and, in that sense, of getting life right. But recent scholarship teaches us otherwise. Scholars have long noted that Aristotle's ethical works are written, and I quote, for the free-born, well-raised male citizen. But in her recent book, From Natural Character to Moral Virtue in Aristotle, Mariska Lewinson has dared to place Aristotle's ethical writings next to his biological works. In retrieving Aristotle's views in the latter, she reveals that in Aristotle's words, and I quote, women, barbarians, and natural slaves are ill-equipped to attain full virtue and happiness. The reason for this is that these, quote, morally unlucky groups face too many biological obstacles. The obstacles that women face arise from the biological fact that their bodies are malformed, an inferiority that infects all aspects of their lives and that follow neatly from Aristotle's robust teleology in the normativity with which he imbues nature. To oversimplify, and I'm really skipping some important details, expanding on the best medical science of his day, especially the Hippocratic text, and his own observations, Aristotle explains the fact that women have menses by the fact that the natural temperature of women's bodies is lower, so they're colder, than male bodies, which prevents women from using up fluids in the right way. The coldness of female bodies correlates with their lower levels of activity compared to male bodies. Because men are hotter than women, they are more active and so have greater power. And you know, the details of this actually make more sense in the summary, makes it sound. His biological account of the difference between female and male bodies is based on careful observation drawn from a variety of animal species and is neatly consistent with his metaphysics, physics, and so on. It's a beautifully consistent system. Given Aristotle's robust teleology, the female body's coldness and its need to shed blood regularly is for the good. The fluids in a female body are imbalanced precisely so that they can be made balanced in bearing children. In Aristotle's words, and I quote, this is what it is to be male and female. This is their difference in power. Within this teleological context, we can begin to understand what led Western philosophy's first systematic biologist to claim the female is, as it were, a degraded or mutilated male. Okay, so let's return to the metaphysics of right agency. Aristotle's robust teleology insists that every animal possesses a set of capacities which it seeks to fulfill and by means of which it becomes a good, i.e. flourishing member of its species. It looks like a woman's soul or anima might share the same cognitive capacities as a man, and so might innately seek to get life right. But as a member of one of the morally unlucky groups, their inferior bodies prevent them from developing their capacities in the way that men can. Now, the following is extremely important in the history of hierarchical difference. For Aristotle and generations of men following him, despite their natural inferiority, women still contribute significantly to the good, but the good to which they contribute is the production of human children. In Aristotle's words, and I quote, "Female nature aims at the best and contributes as it does for the sake of generation." Galen of Paragonon, a very prominent philosopher of medicine whose views came to be associated with Aristotle, makes the point this way. "Now, just as mankind is the most perfect of all animals, so within mankind, the man is more perfect than the woman." Galen explains that it is for the sake of generation that, and I quote, "the female has been made less perfect than the male, which provided no small advantage for humanity." He continues, "Indeed, you ought not to think that our Creator would purposely make half of humanity imperfect and, as it were, mutilated, unless there was some great advantage to that mutilation. Nor is that all. Like many other prominent philosophers of medicine during the time, Aristotle explains the woman's physical deformity in that it renders them morally mutilated as well. What he writes is worth quoting at length. "Because the woman is colder and less spirited than the man, a woman is more compassionate," so hold on to that thought, compassionate, I'll come back to that. "She's more compassionate than a man. She's also less hopeful than a man, more void of shame, more false of speech, more deceptive, and more difficult to rouse to action." I say, huh, to that. Aristotle then pushes this teleological point in his commitment to health one step further. Like many philosophers who followed Aristotle, the natural difference among types of agents entailed a political one. According to Aristotle, it follows from women's natural inferiority that they must be overseen and regulated. In his work on politics, Aristotle announces, and I quote, "As regard the sexes, the man is by nature superior and the female inferior, the male the ruler and the female the subject." So let's briefly return to our metaphysics of right agency. Aristotle exemplifies how easy it is for a philosopher to see all the parts of nature as fundamentally good and human nature as striving toward the good, while comfortably accommodating female inferiority as part of the world's order and goodness. For robust teleologists like Aristotle, the subordination of women was not just natural, it was required for the proper flourishing of humanity. To retrieve Aristotle's biological works and include them in the study of his philosophy gives us the opportunity to raise a number of important questions about objectivity, about the social construction of hierarchies, about epistemic injustices of all sorts, and of course, the many questions that arise from Aristotle's metaphysics of right agency. For example, who can get educated and why and how? It is difficult to overestimate the influence that Aristotle's views about women had in the history of philosophy and medicine. His philosophy formed the curriculum, as probably you know, for all of European universities beginning by the 14th century, and his biological writings were read and revered until the end of the 19th century, although beginning in the 17th century, they were often combined with temporary text. So let me just show you a little bit as opposed to tell you. Here's the frontispiece of a very important textbook written by a German professor in 1616. The figures are Hippocrates on the left and Aristotle on the right. And notice the bottom band there. It shows it's an illustration of a medical exam, a dissection, and the articles that doctors would use to create health. Now notice this. Another book on anatomy, this one of 1666, in which the author interweaves theological ideas drawn, that's Thomas of Aquinas, Divinus Thomas, as it's called, as he's called here, with an Aristotelian Galenic medical theory. So we have here Thomas and Galen. And finally, I want to point out this amazing 18th century book in English, combining the expertise offered by midwives, the author interviewed and learned things from midwives within the biology of Aristotle. You get the point. Aristotle's influence continued for hundreds of years. As a conclusion to this part of section two, I want to be clear about what I'm not saying. Many, many famous philosophers have made remarks that are sexist, racist, anti-Semitic, or homophobic. As disturbing as such remarks are, they are not what concern me here. While we might debate whether we should teach someone who we know to be, for example, a raving anti-Semite, if those views are not supported in his philosophical writings, I consider that a different matter. What concerns me here is, to return to the words of Cynthia Townley, our invested ignorance as historians who have misrepresented the reality of the canonical figures and their systems. So the point is this, that when historians of philosophy retrieve and take seriously writings of the sort I'm interested in, that is, writings that argue for social hierarchies, we give our colleagues and our students materials that raise empowering and important questions. We get to have philosophically informed conversations about how brilliant men might embrace extremely offensive views, how dominant people construct arguments to maintain their dominance, and how people of power, to quote Kimberly Crenshaw, speak with an authoritative universal voice. Okay, empowering, this is the second part of my lecture, which is shorter. As I said, the second strategy for empowering philosophy is to use philosophy's past as a means to include philosophically rich texts by women, people of color, Islamicut, and Jewish thinkers who have been left out of philosophy's past, but whose works have contemporary relevance. My example of this sort of strategy is short, but I think pretty mind-blowing. I'll give a painfully oversimple historical sweep of the challenges faced by medieval women in the Latin West and the radical philosophy they created in response, a philosophy that denied all social hierarchies. To oversimplify, early Christianity was replete with women speaking out, teaching, and even preaching. A battle ensued about the appropriateness of this. Conservative voices, some of whom turned to Platonist views about the need of the soul to dwell in itself, which they combined with Aristotelian ideas about inferiority of female bodies, that all helped them conclude, as Aristotle had, that women were morally mutilated and should be subordinate to men. Sorry, where am I? All right. In the New Testament, some of Paul's letters represent the conservative movement. I quote, there are many such passages from Paul. A woman must receive instruction with entire submissiveness, for I do not allow a woman to teach or exercise authority over a man, but to remain quiet. Or as the prominent second century philosopher and theologian Clement of Alexandria summarized the point, to act is the mark of a man, to suffer that of the woman. And suffer they did. There is no evidence of significant philosophical writings by women between the fourth century and the 11th. Maybe they didn't write. Maybe they wrote and their works were suppressed. We'll probably never know. But beginning in the 12th century, women began to do philosophy. It was a philosophy done in small spaces by humble means. Women wrote from the confines of their cells and monasteries, where they often went to escape the challenges of procreation. Many chose, and I just was blown away when I discovered this as a thing, many chose to become anchoresses. These are women who who had themselves basically locked in very small rooms where they could contemplate and do philosophy. They often had a window, by the way, out to the public, and they apparently became like the local therapist in some cases. But ostensibly their position as an anchoress was to contemplate God. But for many, the result of the escape from the struggles of being a wife and procreator was to read and write spiritual meditations. You can tell that women began to write because powerful men started complaining. The chancellor of the University of Paris, for example, Jean Gersin, writing in the early 14th century, writes, "The female sex is forbidden to teach in public. All women's teaching, particularly formal teaching by word and by writing, is to be held suspect. The reason is clear. Following Eve's legacy, women are easily seduced and determined seducers, and because it is not proven that they are witnesses to divine grace. In fact, if a woman wrote too much like a man, she faced grave dangers. Remember Teresa of Avila. Before she became a global rock star, she raised suspicion for writing as clearly as she did. One prominent professor of philosophy argued her works must have been dictated by the devil because no woman would be capable of writing so clearly and insightfully on her own. So perhaps it's not surprising that these attempts at philosophy by late medieval women are tentative, rhetorically humble, and less than systematic. The women who did write had to find authority by theological means. So a late 14th century anchoress, in fact, the woman who lived in that little room right there, just wrote the following: "Just because I'm a woman, therefore must I therefore believe that I must not tell you about the goodness of God when I saw his wish that it should be known." And then she offers a really interesting metaphysics of right agency. Now, one of my current projects, as Tommy mentioned, is to provoke a radical rethinking of the history of philosophy between 1200 and 1700. Among other things, I want to show that the boundary that's been drawn between late medieval and early modern philosophy is misguided, and that late medieval thinkers foresaw many of the ideas that are taken to be distinctively modern, e.g. about the self, about self-knowledge, about what's called the subjective turn, and even some of the so-called Enlightenment views about equality and dignity. And perhaps most surprisingly, I argue that it is these medieval women who were the main purveyors of some of these so-called modern ideas. Here's a part of the medieval philosophy that historians of philosophy have entirely ignored. There's a string of medieval and early modern women, and a few men too, who read in some way new ways the Platonic demand that the soul reside in itself. Instead of relying so much on reason as the capacity to ultimate knowledge, they began to explore their experiences and affects. The demand became that, in meditating, one would explore and develop the right affects. Because women were supposed to be better at suffering, remember Clement, and because they were supposed to be more compassionate than men, remember Aristotle, women of the Middle Ages took it upon themselves to be experts in compassion, which could be provoked by attending to the suffering of others. The metaphysics of right agency that developed assumed that compassion and sympathy were requisites for getting life right, and that all human beings had those capacities. I call this the metaphysics of sympathy. Now, fast forward to Anne Conway, who I'm writing a book on, and whose philosophy is a radical commitment to the equality of all human beings. So not only am I writing this book on her, we're doing a new translation and edition of her work, which I think will make understanding her much, much easier. She's the figure that's, we don't even know what she looks like, but this may or may not be an image of her. Her arguments are much too complicated to go into now, so I'll just mention a couple of her main conclusions, which will give you a sense of how radical her views are. For Conway, all human beings are innately capable of reason, capacity, love, and so on. Over a series of lives, all human beings will develop all of these capacities fully, and so all people will get life right. As she writes, every human being is capable of a further and more perfect degree of life, ever greater and greater to infinity. Finally, she intends for her radical perfectionism, as I call it, to appeal to Christians, Jews, Muslims, and people of the world. There ain't no hierarchy here. So before turning to my conclusion, it's important to note that although my main focus has been on the history of social hierarchies constructed around sex and gender as a means to empower philosophy, the same kind of retrieval project as a means to empower philosophy is underway by a number of scholars who are focusing on issues concerning race. As Tommy mentioned, Melvin Rogers has joined me as co-editor of the book series that Eileen O'Neill and I started, Oxford New Histories of Philosophy. And as we summarize the motivation behind that series, we want to make available a text by underrepresented figures and monographs or essays on some of those figures. But as Melvin writes about the movement in Africana studies, which he represents, he wrote in an email this: "The widespread interest in African American political philosophy in the broader category of Africana philosophy is stimulated by a desire to understand better than we do now how Black people in the West have grappled with the problems of slavery, colonialism, and empire, and the underlying logic of white supremacy alongside the emergence of the otherwise philosophically rich and noble ideas of freedom and equality." Scholars like Laurie Balfour, Chike Jeffers, Tommy Curry, our own Tommy Shelby, Robert Gooding Williams, and many others both attempt to expand our philosophical histories and retrieve understudied parts of its past, and I quote Melvin again, to enrich and reimagine our moral and political lives. So for example, this is a workshop that we just had at Columbia under for my Center for New Narratives, a philosophy produced it or organized it. And the person on the left is Sorwana de la Cruz, a Mexican nun, but Melvin Rogers and Bob Gooding Williams discuss the very, very interesting political writings of David Martin and Martin Delaney and David Walker. And again, this philosophy that I've never heard of, texts that I've never read, that are extremely rich and interesting. Okay, so here's my conclusion in three parts. First, the historical part. We must cease and desist with the triumphal march of great men approach to the history of philosophy. The story I've told makes clear that even the standard account of medieval philosophy that only includes the greats like Aquinas, Scotus, and Occam is just wrong. The sharp divide between late medieval and early modern philosophy is misleading. Not only is Descartes not our father, some of his arguments and some aspects of his meditation on the self and subjectivity have roots in the works of medieval meditations. Late medieval and early modern philosophy contains arguments for equality, dignity, and justice for all human beings long before the philosophers of the so-called Enlightenment. Conclusion part two. Once we take the beads off the string, we begin to see that philosophy's past is a treasure trove of subtle ideas and arguments. The myopic vision we've taken to the past has prevented us from seeing and then using this wealth of ideas in a way that can enliven our discipline. I've tried to show that taking problems of contemporary interest to philosophy's past, by doing that, we can begin to speak to the interest of women, people of color, and other marginalized groups, and in that way, empower philosophy. Given the extraordinary challenges we face today, I would think that we need all the help we can get. In closing, I'd like to answer a question that I hope, anyway, that some of you are asking, namely, that you'd like, although you'd like to include some of these new problems and texts in your courses, you don't quite know where to go for help. The good news is that there is a lot of new resources available and much more on the way. Now, there's a handout that we uploaded on the APA app, which has a list of sites that are kind of global sites. There's some in Germany, there's one in Denmark. The most important ones are on the website for my center, the Center for New Narratives and Philosophy, which is a kind of clearinghouse for sites around the world that actually do things like, for example, have texts by German women. And there's a project called Project Vox at Duke University, which has syllabi that include a lot of these diverse figures. Also very important, there's a new anthology of early modern philosophy that will soon be published and includes many texts by these underrepresented figures. It's edited by Marcy Lascano and Lisa Shapiro, and it will soon appear online with Broadview Press. And finally, this series that Melvin Rogers and I are editing will be very helpful as more books come out. The series is devoted, I mean, these are just the books that have come out so far, but the series is devoted to publishing editions of many, many forgotten works by women and people of color alongside philosophical studies. We have a book, for example, on Mexican philosophy, analytic philosophy of the 20th century, a finely done collection of Margaret Cavendish's work. Antonia Lalordo is somewhere in the audience here. She has a very important new edition of a work by Mary Shepherd, who herself was a very prominent philosopher in her day, referring to or responding to Thomas Reed, David Hume, and so on. Don Garrett, who's sitting right there, is doing an edition of another work by her. As Tommy mentioned, I'm working on Anne Conway. We'll have a new translation of her work, and I hope my book on her will be important. But there are also many important books underway in our Africana list. For example, Robert Gooding Williams is doing a monograph on Martin Delaney's political philosophy. And the series is going global. We have a translation underway by, who knew, early modern Korean women who were neo-Confucianists and had apparently very interesting things to say. So to conclude, there's a growing movement among historians of philosophy to create new narratives and histories. We hope you'll join us in our commitment to empower philosophy in this way. Thank you.